This is a podcast from the October 27th, 2008 meeting of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. The podcast features discussions relating to commercialism and economic health in intercollegiate athletics. These sessions are the first in a year-long series of planned discussions on the economics and finance of college sports that will culminate in a major report on the realities facing universities and athletic programs in late 2009. For more information on the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, visit www.knightcommission.org. This second session related to commercialism in sports and athletes' rights in the 21st century, how the new media landscape and fan interactivity is impacting traditional amateurism principles. This session featured the perspective from college athletes relating to NCAA amateurism principles about the commercial use of college players' names, images, and likenesses. The podcast begins with an introduction from Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics co-chairman R. Gerald Turner, president of Southern Methodist University.
Given the past panel and the discussion, well then I think it's absolutely appropriate that we follow that discussion about legal and procedural implications of commercialism and amateurism and the intersection between those things in the specific case of the fantasy games. But as the committee, as the commission noted, it's on a much broader scale than just that one particular outlet. So it's good that we have student athletes and those who have been student athletes, been most directly affected with this, to come before us now. And so I'm going to introduce our four all at once, and then we'll come back and have each one of them make opening comments, and then have the opportunity for commission members to engage in a dialogue with them. First is Jeremy Bloom, who is a three-time world champion and two-time Olympic champion in skiing. He played football at the University of Colorado, where he was named a first-team freshman All-American in 2002. And he played football for two years before discontinuing his collegiate career in order to accept endorsements. And Jeremy graduated from Colorado in 2006. Kerry Kinney is chair of the NCAA Division I Student Athlete Advisory Committee and is a former basketball player at Lafayette College. Kerry currently serves as an intern in the Big Ten Conference office, focusing on governance issues. In addition to several NCAA committee assignments, he served on the NCAA study group for use of student athletes' names and likenesses. So, Kerry, we're glad to have you with us. Craig Krenzel is a former football player at Ohio State University. He was a three-time Academic All-American Big Ten honoree. He graduated summa cum laude and received the Vincent DePaul Drady Award, known as the Academic Heisman. And he was also the quarterback for the national championship team. Then Marvin Lewis is associate athletic director at Georgia State University and former basketball player at Georgia Tech. He earned a degree in management and has worked as a certified public accountant. He was a three-time academic All-ACC honoree while he was at Tech. So we're delighted to have the four of you with us. And Jeremy, we'll start with you.
Okay, thank you. I'm delighted to be here today and thoroughly enjoyed this morning's discussions and felt like the issues that were brought up are extremely important to college athletics. And before I start, I think it's important to note that I have prepared a discussion, but none of my comments today will be about my past dealings with the NCAA and my right to be a professional skier and an amateur football player. And although I probably will be very critical at times, I've done my best to construct my views in a way, an unbiased, objective way. But we are all here to discuss these important matters that face college athletics today. The popularity and revenue stream has never been higher, and the climate of amateur athletics continues to change at a breakneck speed. And I believe it's essential that the governing body of college athletics is both willing and able to adapt those changes with that popularity and the changes. And it's my personal belief as history as our measuring tool, that the NCAA has done an unsatisfactory job of changing those rules with the athlete's best interest in mind. The NCAA has made numerous decisions in regards to TV contracts, endorsement deals, jersey sales, and coaches' salaries that have undermined their primary focus of preserving amateurism. And they continue to blur the line between amateur sports and those of the professional level. You know, when we look at college football today, it's very difficult to see any difference between the NCAA brand and that of the NFL. They are both played in endorsement-filled arenas. They both enjoy multi-million dollar television contracts. They both even pay their coaches around the same amount of money. And in fact, in 2006, Bob Stoops of Oklahoma made more money than the head coach of the Chicago Bears, Lovie Smith. And by the way, they went to a Super Bowl that year, if you're following. And now the NFL and the NCAA are both sharing in very similar brands of fantasy football. And it was my understanding that this is the first time that they have used student-athletes' names, but Mr. Renfro brought up that they may have been doing it for 10 years now, and I think that that's a problem. Now, merchandising the sport for profit, compliance with these fantasy football leagues, in addition to permitting the exploitation of student-athletes through their jersey sales, should be interpreted as an intentional contradiction to its own definition of amateurism and should help shed light to those who may be less informed on the hypocritical manner in which the NCAA governs. Commercialized profit entities such as the NFL engage in these types of activities, and the goal here is to make money, period. The NCAA's claim that the fact that they sell these jerseys but don't put the name on the back of them so it's not meant to represent that one player is contradicted by the fact that these universities identify their most marketable players and instruct their equipment sponsors to manufacture the numbers of those jerseys. Video game companies are also permitted to engage in this type of action. Companies like EA Sports contact media departments of these universities to gather headshots, height and weight, color of skin, and every statistical information that they can come up with to develop these video games. I believe if the NCAA was serious about preserving these issues, first they would make every jersey sold in college athletics today a unanimous number, maybe a double zero. They would limit the access of these video game manufacturers and certainly put an end to the fantasy football ability to use the names and likenesses of the players. Now, while the NFL and NCAA do engage in similar practices, there are, however, a couple of notable differences. And these differences are highlighted in the benefits to the players. First, college students aren't able to fund some sort of union that could look out for their best interest. And secondly, the student-athletes are certainly precluded from the profits that their talents generate. Third, scholarships are often not enough to live on, while professionals make a large amount of money ensuring the future of their families. You know, this convoluted message that the NCAA continues to send, in addition to the hypocritical manner in which they govern, has made it unclear to what their own definition of amateurism has really become. Do they think it's amateur because a basketball player doesn't have the same rights to expand on his or her talents as a student with an academic scholarship? Do they think it's amateur because they don't allow universities to cover scholarships at the cost of attendance? Or do they think it's amateur because a college athlete who was diagnosed with brain cancer at the age of 10 wrote a book while he was playing baseball at the University of Oklahoma, and because his name was attached to a corporate product, the NCAA stripped his eligibility and took away his right to play baseball? And, you know, instead of answering these important questions and shedding some light into how the NCAA makes their decisions, they hide behind the same closed-door policies that they've always had. And, in fact, a couple years ago, I testified at a congressional hearing here in D.C. entitled Due Process and the NCAA. In that hearing, Senator Baucus brought up that in 1991, the NCAA formed a committee made up of a Supreme Court judge, a Solicitor General, former Attorney General, and several law school professors This committee studied how the NCAA could better make their enforcement system better. And based off their findings, they concluded that the NCAA should allow open hearings. And 17 years later, they continue to ignore the findings of their own study. And with $485 billion a year, still claim that they can't afford to give due process, something that our common law tradition has been with us for hundreds of years. I'd like to touch back on the cost of attendance issue. Some of you may be familiar with the lawsuit that some former student athletes filed in February of 2006, citing antitrust violations with the NCAA. This case is particularly interesting because for the first time in the NCAA's history, they settled this case out of court. And it's not only my opinion, but a lot of attorneys and experts' opinions that the merits of this case were so strong that was part of the reason that the NCAA wanted to settle this case. And I read through the settlement agreement and was disappointed a little bit because, my personal opinion, the fact that the NCAA paid these attorneys $8.6 million to settle this suit, I believe that had some reason why it was settled and agreed to and wasn't fully fought to the end, because I believe it really could have had a profound impact on college athletics. Other ideas how the NCAA could help athletes would be some sort of idea of a stipend, but among other reasons, the NCAA claims that this would give some universities a competitive advantage. But really, the notion the NCAA's interest in providing a level playing ground to all their member institutions again falls short of their actions. There are many changes that could be instituted in the current rule book to reflect this principle. This would include, first and foremost, unilaterally capping salaries of college coaches. It's foolish to think that Brady Hoke, the head coach at Ball State, has the same ability to recruit the nation's best athletes as Nick Saban at Alabama. Alabama has better coaches, better trainers, better locker rooms, better facilities, better dining halls, and more lucrative TV contracts. The NCAA could take measures to enact mandates on the size of locker rooms, practice facilities, weight rooms, and athletic departments. And they could also require all student athletes to wear the same NCAA-branded uniforms. This idea that the NCAA will allow some advantages, but not all, is, again, another inconsistent message. In 2004, some of our country's most brightest individuals who write for the Harvard Business Review said that the number one monopoly in the United States is not Microsoft, not Walmart, and not OPEC, but it's the NCAA. College athletics has evolved into big-time business, where the financial stakes are being measured not in millions, but rather that in the billions, and it has long outlived the ideal of amateurism. The reality is the NCAA's decisions on numerous issues have not followed the same path as their founding principles. It's time as peoples and fans that we remove ourselves from the rock that we've been living under and accept the fact that college athletics is not amateur anymore. The sky didn't fall on the Olympic movement when the IOC decided that requiring athletes to be poor wasn't what united the world and brought about pure competition. In conclusion, I'd like to leave you with what, in my opinion, is a reality and my ideas how to embrace the changes. First, let's accept that everybody knows that intercollegiate sports, particularly football and basketball, are significantly for-profit entities. Secondly, let's get rid of the concept of amateurism here for a second and accept the commercialization of NCAA sports and see that athletes are indeed a part of that commercialization. Thirdly, instead of putting a governor on this commercialization, let's expand on it. For example, sell jerseys in university towns with the names of athletes on them. Give student athletes more opportunities to expand on their talents and popularity. Sign deals with commercial sport outlets to increase profits. And follow some of the strategies that professional sports do and apply these to intercollegiate athletics. And I believe if it's done correctly, this could significantly increase the revenue. And in the spirit of the presidential campaign this year, take the additional revenue and spread it around. Administrative organizations, universities, and student athletes should all be a part of this equation. I'm probably running out of time, so I'll highlight this. A couple of the ideas on how to filter down this additional revenue would be fund scholarships and living expenses at the level that truly represents the student-athlete's costs, allocate additional funds to pay to help pay for year-round medical insurance for the student-athletes, expand such funds that help former student-athletes afford graduate programs, and contribute to an established pension, IRA, or trust fund that the athletes may be able to dip into for their future. I'd like to ask everyone, what is wrong with additional benefits to the very people who upon the whole system is built? Mr. Renfro said that student-athletes are not employees, but it's important to note that we do employ him and the NCAA and the purpose in which they exist. If you take these ideas and expand on the commercial aspect of intercollegiates, the sky won't fall, and I certainly don't agree with paying student-athletes. Finally, it would take the NCAA to do the right thing by enhancing the benefits to the young men and women who make this all happen. And rest assured that under these changes, no college athlete in the near future will ever get rich by playing his or her sport, nor will intercollegiate athletics ever become a minor league playing ground for the professional game. These fear-inducing claims are just more of the same unsubstantiated excuses made by the NCAA to scare off any real change. I thank the Knight Commission for bringing these issues to the table and giving me a platform to share my thoughts and opinions with all of you. And I would encourage the university presidents to stand up and acknowledge that these important measures should be adapted, and there's changes that need to be made to make the revenue sharing more proportionate and bring the NCAA up to speed and into the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure there'll be some questions as we get into that section. But first, let's go ahead with Kerry.
Thank you, President Turner. President Turner, President Kerwin, members of the commission, and esteemed guests in the audience today, I thank you for extending the invitation to have me sit before you today and share some of my thoughts and experiences, both as a former student-athlete as well as the chair of the Division I National Student-Athlete Advisory Committee. And in order to preface some of my comments and opinions today, I just thought it may be beneficial to the commission to explain a little bit about what the National Student-Athlete Advisory is and what our role is in an advisory capacity to the NCAA. The National Student-Athlete Advisory Committee has been around for close to 20 years, and it's a 31-member committee at the Division I level, one representative from each of the 31 multi-sport conferences that make up the Division I level in the NCAA. We have three in-person meetings a year and countless email conference call and internet meeting conversations throughout the course of the year. And what our group is charged with examining is student-athlete well-being at the Division I level. So a slew of issues including financial aid, recruiting, playing and practice seasons, nutrition, per diem, anything that basically affects your experience as a Division I student-athlete. It comes across our plate, and we have a chance to comment on some of these areas, including legislation that is pending in the legislative cycle during each of the years. So student-athletes at the Division I level, through us as a de facto representative voice of the Division I student-athlete population, has a chance to put their voice out there on certain issues, and we have had a chance to affect the outcome of certain issues in the past, which we are certainly appreciative of, and we have a role with the Division I Leadership Council, Division I Legislative Council. We have a chance to meet with the Division I Board of Directors every year. So we have a chance to get our voice and our opinions out there. And a lot of my comments today are going to be on behalf of my organization or my committee, the countless conversations that we've had with Division I student-athletes during my two-plus years on the committee. And then I'm also going to comment a little bit from my own personal opinion as well as a former Division I student-athlete. Even though the two opinions do not differ greatly, I will attempt to delineate between these as much as possible during our conversations today. Commercialism, as our group has talked about it during the last two-plus years, and we have had a great chance to discuss it because there were several legislative proposals in the last two or three legislative cycles that dealt specifically with student-athlete names, images, and likeness, promotional activities, and the like. Our group has always had the general feeling, and when I say our group, again, representing the countless conversations we've had with Division I student-athletes, that student-athletes should be able to partake in these promotional activities or commercial activities to the extent that they are representing successful models of their individual university or college that they attend. We've thought that in these promotional ads or commercial activities that certain standards, certain values, core values, I guess you could call them, of intercollegiate athletics should be portrayed. So that being portraying the student part of student-athlete, putting the team before the individual so that it's just not Tim Tebow out there in all of these ads representing the University of Florida, but rather the entire University of Florida football team, and not just the football team, but the rest of the athletic department as well. Things like integrity, character, purity of the game. We are talking about intercollegiate athletics here, the amateurism principles upheld in that, and purity of the game is one of the greatest aspects of college athletics. Just talking to Craig a little bit before the conversation today, you know, the excitement and the passion and everything that surrounds collegiate athletics is something that is distinct to this sector of athletics. And I think to be able to portray that in these types of ads is one thing that we always focused on. Teamwork, also tradition, not only of the sport that you play, but the university that you are a part of, as well as the team that you are a part of, kind of honoring those that have come before you and paying homage to the steps that they laid in order for you to be where you are as a college athlete. On several pieces of legislation that were in the 2007 legislative cycle, specifically proposals 2007-25, 2007-26, and 2007-28, which you may or may not be familiar with, but these were attempts to codify the current language of the NCAA manual to try and bring the promotional activities and use of student-athlete name and likeness up to speed with what is currently going on in the world that we live in, the technology-driven world that we live in. These three proposals were tabled, which was the genesis of what Mr. Renfro referred to earlier as the task force on commercial activities that is comprised of university presidents and athletic directors to examine this issue. One of the inherent flaws that our committee saw in these three pieces of legislation was the fact that although the athletic department had the opportunity to sign off on whether or not to use student athletes' names, images, or likenesses, specifically game footage was mostly what we were talking about here, the student athlete never had a say in whether or not they were able to kind of put themselves aside if they didn't want to be included in one of these ads. For example, if you have a student athlete who, because of their background, may be a vegan, but one of the sponsors for a university is McDonald's, would a student athlete have the ability to preclude themselves and not be involved in that advertisement because of their upbringing and their background? So one of the inherent flaws that we saw in that was the fact that it wasn't going both ways and that the student athlete should have an opportunity to sign off, even if it is a team initiative, a team calendar with you know, sponsorships at the bottom, what have you. The student athlete should have some say in being able to remove themselves from that individual promotional activity. Specifically on the fantasy issue, our group has not had a chance to officially talk about this. The issue really came to the forefront a week after our in-person meeting in July. This upcoming November, we will be talking about this in full force, and hopefully we'll be able to put out a position on behalf of our committee. But one of the things that, from a personal level, to me, fantasy adds no added value to the sports that it represents. It's a way for members of the general public to live vicariously, specifically in this instance, through 18 to 22-year-old student-athletes, specifically at the FBS football level, and apparently men's basketball as well in the upcoming winter, from what I've heard. It's a chance for the general public to latch on to these student-athletes and live vicariously through them, putting extra pressure on them. You know, it may be trivial, but to be walking across campus and have countless other members of the general student body saying, hey, you screwed up my fantasy team this week, you know, it's something very trivial, but at the same time, as an 18 to 22-year-old who may not be mature enough to handle something like that, it's definitely a situation where I think it's very unnecessary to have fantasy tied to college athletics. Again, this is something that I think, as Mr. Renfro and many others referred to in the first session here, it's not going away, and it's not something that I think is a closed book yet, and I think it's a great chance specifically for our committee to speak up about it and hopefully have some influence on what happens with the outcome of the situation. But I look forward to hearing Mr. Krenzel and Mr. Lewis's remarks here and look forward to answering any questions that you may have for me in my role with my experience. And again, thank you for having me today.
Thank you, Kerry, very much. Craig?
Well, first of all, I would like to begin by just thanking the Knight Commission for the opportunity to be here today to represent current and former student athletes And I also like to thank you for your work and what you do to try to uphold the integrity of NCAA athletics and what you do for the student athletes and their educations and trying to maintain that importance. I do appreciate that. I come here today with the ability to see things from multiple different angles. I was fortunate enough to play football at Ohio State University, have some success there. I was fortunate enough to play a couple years in the NFL. I have seen the sport of football from both angles. I've seen it from the amateur angle as a collegiate athlete, and I've seen it as a professional athlete where, as everyone knows, you get paid quite, myself not as much as others, I wish, but you still get paid quite handsomely, even at league minimum. That being said, I look at the two different sports and my experiences in my 5 years at Ohio State and my 2+ years in the NFL and only see one distinct difference between the NFL professional version and the college version, and that is that the players don't get paid to play on the field. And I come today, I uphold that. I do not think football players or college athletes in general should be paid for their performance on the field. I think it is the major difference is what we've already highlighted, being that there is a certain passion, there is a certain innocence, and there is a certain spirit that comes from men's basketball, the Final Four, the tournament, that comes from watching football during the fall, crowning a national champion. But at the end of the day, the fans connect with these players as students first, and I think that is very important. That obviously they're passionate. Obviously they're not always happy with the outcome. I obviously wasn't happy with our outcome last Saturday. But that being said, fans relate. They understand for the most part that it is 18 to 22-year-old children out there learning, growing, acting as students, representing their families and their universities. Whereas in the NFL, fans get a lot more hostile a lot quickly when you're paying a guy $3 million a year and he throws 3 interceptions. But I'm trying to come here today not as a former college football player, as a former NFL football player rather, but I'm going to sit here today as a former student athlete, and I tried to embrace that term as best as I could. I put a high premium on my academic education and how I could use that to further my career and my life, and I'm very fortunate for that opportunity. In no way, as I mentioned, do I think football players, basketball players, athletes in general at the college level should be compensated for their pay on the field. I believe that the university's investment into the athlete with an education and all that they provide is more than enough for what the university gets back in terms of ticket sales and how they run their athletic department. But where I see there to be a developing issue is from third-party entities, non-related businesses that can go out there and profit off of names, likenesses, images of these student-athletes. I think there's, as we've seen from a legal standpoint, millions of different issues that will be at hand. But I think ultimately at the end of the day, it's not fair to student-athletes that there are people allowed to go out there, and sometimes it's even the universities in terms of merchandising and ticket sales. I don't feel that that is a core portion of how they should be able to generate revenue when it comes to the individual sports. So at the end of the day, I really firmly believe that there should be opportunities for student-athletes, and I think it should be embraced. This commercialism should be embraced, as has been mentioned earlier, and almost advanced to a point where any money generated from third-party entities, businesses, we live in a great country. I think they should be allowed to go out there and use their ideas to try to create a living. At the same time, I don't believe they should be able to exploit student-athletes the way they will so that they can go make money without being able to share some of that with the athletes. And I don't mean necessarily sharing it with athletes in the form of, at the end of the year, you sold X amount of number 15 jerseys in Gainesville, so here's a check. You know, I think there's going to be multiple different ways. We heard about the trust fund. I think I don't see any reason why money can't be generated, put into a fund to help athletes continue their education. The universities, the NCAA, they say that they are students first. So I don't look at it and think that the public would ever look at it as a these guys are getting paid. They would say, hey, there's money out there, and they are continuing to try to develop with the changing landscape of our economy and trying to help these players advance their careers. And I once again thank you for all you do. I thank you for the opportunity, and I am very much looking forward to taking part in the rest of this discussion.
Thank you, Craig. Marvelous.
I just want to say first thank you to the Knight Commission for allowing me to come and speak. I think I'm in a unique situation with being an athletic administrator, as well as being a former student athlete. So I think in many levels, I tried my best in my discussions and in my conversations with not only my mentors about this issue, but other teammates, that I really wanted to try to step back and say, as a student athlete, how do I really feel? Because administratively, of course, the additional travel costs, the additional cost of education, administratively, if I can find another revenue stream for my institution, I'm going to try to take advantage of that. And taking a step back and saying, well, take the administrative piece out, and as a student athlete, what brought me to an institution? The resources that are at that institution, whether that's educationally, whether that's the coaching staff, whether that's the weight room, what have you. Those are the things that brought me to that institution. Do I realize and do I know that the marketing and the commercialization of that institution and maybe some of the athletes that are there currently, is that something that I know is being done? Yes. But in that same right, that's what's attracting me to that institution. That's what's getting me to say, I want to go to Georgia Tech. I want to go to an Ohio State. So with that being said, I think overall, the commercialization is already there. Yes, the number 15 jersey doesn't have a name on it. But overall, I know what that number 15 jersey represents. And I see that jersey and say, I want my number on that jersey. I want to have the opportunity to see my name in the EA Sports game. Or not necessarily my name, but my image on that EA Sports game. I know many times we were in our rooms just playing, you know, if it's Madden, if it's playing NCAA basketball, whatever the game was, we were generally excited to see our image or to see our abilities in that game. We didn't think about the money that was coming out at the end of the day. We weren't thinking about how the institution was making money. We were just excited, and the pure nature of NCAA basketball and athletics as a whole, we were just excited to be a part of something like that. And I didn't want to lose that. I didn't want to lose that, not one bit. So when I look at, you know, paying student athletes, to be honest with you, yes, initially I would say I want to be paid because I know the 40 hours or the 40, 50 hours that I, you know, work out and I'm on the field, I feel like I'm at a disadvantage because I don't have an opportunity to work. I don't have an opportunity to do some of the things that the other student athletes are doing or other students are doing. But deep down, I know that the resources that I have are different than the regular student population. I realize that the opportunities that I have as a student athlete far outweigh a stipend check for right now. We talked about, Carrie and I talked about, you know, we receive meal checks. After a game, I might receive $10, $20. And does that $20 go towards a meal? No, I use that on something frivolous. So whether that's going out that night, whether that's hanging, whatever it is, I don't use that for its intended purpose. So as a student athlete, I don't feel as though we should get paid. But I do feel like if you're going to commercialize and you're going to use images and use names and likenesses, then we should receive some benefit. That benefit we talked about earlier, where I don't like necessarily the trust fund idea, but just as the student or special assistance fund and the student athlete opportunity fund, setting up some type of fund so in the end we still receive the benefit of that commercialization. So we still have the opportunity to, whether it's classes about what it's like to be a professional athlete, whether that's additional computers, whether that's, you know, medical insurance or what have you, just having that opportunity to receive those benefits without it coming directly to each individual student athlete. From the administrative side, I know how difficult it would be if I had a Tim Tebow and we had to find out a way to pay Tim Tebow a stipend or find some way to pay him directly, but not take care of the other student athletes. I think that would be very difficult for us to do. And I think with Title IX and all the things that we're trying to do with equality, I think that would totally negate the equality and the Title IX idea that all our student athletes, whether it's a revenue-generating sport or not, should receive the same resources and equivalent resources across the board. So I think overall, we have to embrace the commercialization. It's already there. But I just think as long as we take that and give it back to the student athletes and give it to them in a way that they can really utilize it, I think we'll be better off. Thank you.
All right. Thank all four of you for your initial presentations. And now we'll open it up for any questions that members might have. Yeah.
Well, I presume that Carrie doesn't think that there's any educational value to fantasy games or fantasy leagues, but I'm curious as to whether the rest of you think so. I've never played any, so I have no idea. And along with that question, I wonder, I think it was, Glenn Wong from the University of Massachusetts suggested there were four alternatives. He suggested, perhaps you heard them, all in, all out, the trust fund, which you were just saying is not appropriate, the exceptional student fund, and maybe that's not any different than the trust fund. Because I'm concerned, how would there be a setup, if you will, that only advantaged the Tim Tebows, but not everybody else? So can all of you or any of you say something about that?
Who would like to go first?
Just go down the line.
Jeremy, okay. Just go down the line. That'll be fine. Alphabetical order again.
To touch on your first question, the educational value of fantasy football, I don't believe that there is one. Secondly, what is the best structure to increase revenue and make it proportionate? I think that's a long, drawn-out discussion of how you protect the interests in keeping student-athletes away from receiving some sort of salary and keeping the purity of that idea, but also increasing the benefits to the student-athletes. And Professor Wong pointed out four interesting ideas that I think you could touch from and come and develop certain sort of mix between all of them to have something that works for the NCAA, have something that works for the student, for the university presidents, and for the student athletes.
Okay. Since I already answered your first question, as you noted, Professor Wong's four business models, I think, is a great example, perspective about where we could potentially be heading, just as ideas, maybe not as concrete end games for this issue. But to touch, the one that jumped out to me a little bit was the last one, the Exceptional Student Athlete Fund. And currently, as Marvin touched on earlier, there are three funds that the NCAA has at the Division I level. There's the Student Athlete Opportunity Fund, the Special Assistance Fund, and the Academic Enhancement Fund. And per the ruling of the settlement that Jeremy talked about earlier with the White case, those funds are now in a $218 million pool for the use of Division I institutions and colleges. And they are all under the least restrictive means of the Student Athlete Opportunity Fund now. So whereas in the past you had to maybe be a Pell Grant recipient to access some of these funds in the Special Assistance Fund, now any student athlete that demonstrates a level of need can have access to these funds. So say you have to travel, goodness forbid you have to travel home for the funeral of a loved one and you don't have a suit. You would be able to use the application process for some of these funds and apply to receive the funding to purchase a suit so that you can travel home and be obviously in appropriate clothing for a funeral of a loved one. That's just one example of one of the things that these three funds can do for student athletes. So again, there is something in place already that potentially benefits all 160,000 Division I student athletes. Sorry?
Emergency funds are not...
You have to show a demonstrated level of need. You can't just walk in and say, hey, I need a suit. Can I walk out with one? But then the other thing similar to what... the other thing similar to what Jeremy and Professor Wong were talking about is maybe setting up more medical benefits for student-athletes. And I know there's comprehensive medical insurance that also came out of a recent ruling in the court system. But one of the things that's very near and dear to me, because I had a teammate that suffered from it, was heart problems. So maybe using some of these funds raised through commercial activities to fund mandatory EKG and heart monitor testing for all incoming freshman student athletes to ensure that their health and well-being, which goes above all else of what they do at a university or institution during their 4 years, is their health and safety. I think that's an example of how you could distribute these funds as well to benefit student athletes without actually giving them a stipend check.
To go back to the first question, personally, I feel it's somewhat laughable for people to try and argue that a fantasy league is informative. If you want to know the score of a game, if you want to know
somebody's statistics. You can quite easily log on to the internet, go to the websites of those universities. You can go to ESPN.com. There's millions of avenues that you can go. If you don't look at the fantasy leagues, you know, CBS claims, well, we don't charge for ours. I think it's laughable that people will buy that, not see the business model that CBS employs, that these fantasy leagues bring how many more millions of people to our site so we can sell how much more advertising. I don't see any way that it's not an entrepreneurial way for organizations and entities to make money. So I think that answers the first question. I think there's multiple different ways to disperse funds to student athletes for education, to further their education, special assistance, all the things that were mentioned. I don't know that the first step is necessarily deciding, well, this is how we need to spend it. I think the first step is actually putting a group together that is going to go out and get it, that's going to go out and fight for the student athletes, that is going to secure that money, all the while developing the model that is also going to be employed essentially on how to spend it and where to put it and how you can help these student athletes in all the different areas of their lives, be it education, be it health insurance. I mean, there's multiple different ways that money could be put to good use.
Marvin?
In regards to fantasy football and just the internet, I think it's just one extra step. I mean, technology is going to continuously change. And yes, this is an issue right now, but like I said, there's going to be more issues to come. Yes, third parties are benefiting, whether it's $19.95 to be a part of that membership on that website. They are benefiting, but I think in the same right, those are the same people that are buying tickets. Those are the same people that are coming to the games. Those are the same people that are buying the jerseys. So I know from the university standpoint, or at least from my standpoint, my role, you know, I see that money coming back too. I see that money coming back to the university and coming back to the students, so then I can provide them with additional resources. So I think, you know, it is an issue, but at the same time, I think overall, the student athletes do benefit. How do I feel as though we should divvy it up? Once again, I go back to the fund idea.
Hey, Jack, and then Anita.
Question for Jeremy. What do you think we can learn in intercollegiate athletics from the developments over the last generation in the Olympic sports? Are there things that we can learn from USA skiing or from the USOC and the IOC as the Olympic sports have wrestled with some of the same questions that now face intercollegiate athletics?
Thank you for that question, because they've really operated under a similar timeline, just in a different time. And the Olympic movement, and I don't pretend to be an expert on the Olympic movement, but it's my understanding that in the beginning, when there wasn't a lot of commercialization, lots and lots, billions and billions of dollars filtering through the system, that it made sense to keep it on strictly amateur competition. But as the popularity grew and as the commercialization grew, the IOC believed that it was important that they share in those additional revenues with the people that compete in the Olympics. So I think the NCAA and university presidents and everybody in the Knight Commission and everybody involved can look at some of the principles that they instituted and see how they too could use some of those ideas to help make this a more proportionate, make college athletics more proportionate.
Anita?
I wonder how serious you can be, not putting you guys on the spot, but in terms of fairness, what about athletes who are injured and then lose their scholarship? Where should they be? And what about women's sports, which could, if there was greater investment, become more popular? Should there be some sense of getting NCAA and the schools to recognize that if in this era of commercialism and popularity making sports more popular, is there some responsibility that's missing? And so in those two, just two areas.
We can go this way this time. Do you want us all to answer? Or do you just want us to go back and forth? I mean, you know, I think I'll start then, and then throw a few ideas out and let everyone else weigh in. As far as the first question, to my knowledge, I am yet to hear of a student athlete losing a scholarship because they've been injured. I think that is one thing that I'm fairly confident is protected. That once you sign and you take that scholarship, you can be stripped of that scholarship for conduct detrimental to the program, to your university, for academic reasons, but you cannot be stripped of that scholarship due to lack of performance on the field or injury or other things of that nature. And in terms of the women's sports, you know, I think advancing commercialization in embracing it and starting with the bigger sports, I think it's only going to generate more revenue, more interest in collegiate sports. And I don't know that any of us are sitting here saying commercialization of football, for example, being probably the largest revenue-generating sport, that money should only stay with football. I think, you know, I think there's multiple ways to spread that money around to student athletes as a whole, to athletic departments, to the students, or to the universities, or to the funds that any student athlete has access to, as long as they qualify and meet certain criteria or of whatever that fund would specify.
Yeah, just
okay.
I'm sorry.
If you've got a comment, then we'll go to another question. Go
just a very brief comment. About your first question, I think one of the things that I've heard during my 2+ years on this committee is, why is this a year-to-year renewable scholarship? You know, why isn't it made for 4 years, you know, so that when you sign, you're there for the 4 years? Also heard many people in my experience say, you know, why don't we open up other funds at the university to be included in an athletic scholarship? Why does it just have to come from the athletic department or from an outside source, which was the case, I believe, with Jeremy, from reading a little bit about his background, but opening up different avenues, whether it be through academic grants, through other resources at the university to help fund those scholarships so that, you know, maybe there are more funds that are already there that can be dispersed to other areas of the athletic department, be it women's sports or what have you. And then if you do have other revenue streams through commercial activities, I totally agree with what Craig said, that it's not going to be specifically streamlined just for football and men's basketball. And it's very interesting that the four of us were football and men's basketball student athletes, so hopefully our comments don't come across as that. But I think it would benefit the entire athletic department by having some of these other revenue streams in place.
Bill, you had a question?
Yeah, let me comment. I missed out on the $15 a quarter laundry fee. So apparently at some point in time there was money available to athletes for providing what would be described as laundry money. And that was eliminated, and I don't know my history, so I don't know why that happened, but I didn't get any of it. Yeah. But the larger question about commercialization we talked about today is there are a few schools who have athletes who could generate income, but the vast majority of the NCAA members don't have athletes who could, in fact, generate the kind of money that we're talking about, these billions of dollars. And so the question becomes, if we went to this exploiting the commercialization, how do you get to and the distribution to those athletes who are at institutions where they're never going to generate the Ohio State or Penn State rivalry that results in the results that happened last Saturday? How do we get to
bring that up?
but how, I mean, we're talking about a handful of schools who are part of the NCAA, and commercialization might apply to some of those athletes, but not all of them. So when you look at the athletes who it would apply to, this is a microcosm of these thousands of athletes who are participating in the NCAA. Is there any sense of
it already exists? These athletically talented institutions are already more wealthy than the ones that are not.
So and the rich get richer.
Unfortunately, that's, you know, it's the kind of the world we live in and the operating model. And just because you can't make every university be able to make the same amount of money, it's not possible. And because that principle can't be attained, I don't think you punish the universities that could increase revenue for educational programs, for the university, for the athletic departments, for the system as a whole. I don't think you put a governor on them, because you'll never make the system completely fair, completely unilaterally, and with the same amount of funding.
Marvin, you want to make a comment, and then Lynn's question.
And I know I'm new to athletic administration, but I almost feel as though, and I wanted some a better response from the NCAA, but if we left it at that level, like some of the other licensing agreements, and that money got pushed to the conferences, and then from there that money got pushed to the institution so that it's all spread out, and it's not just the Floridas or the Ohio States that gain that revenue, but we leave it at the top tier and funnel that money down to the individual institutions that way.
Okay, Kerry, you wanted then Lynn, Jerry, and Elston questions.
I certainly appreciate your comments, and just for my own well-being, just wanted to clear up some of the nomenclature that you used. I thoroughly detest the word exploitation in this sense, in this issue. Prefer the word utilization of commercial activities, just because I think that that's more the route that we need to focus on as far as benefiting student-athletes in the long run, utilizing this avenue rather than exploiting it for all that it's worth. So that's just for my own personal well-being. But similar to what Marvin said, similar to what we do with the men's basketball money that comes down from the NCAA tournament, sort of a revenue-sharing program within the conference may be a way to help the have-nots who may not have the access to the same funds as the Penn State, Ohio State that you mentioned, to be able to share that revenue amongst the conference. And although, you know, that raises the issue of competitive equity, you know, I think in the long run would benefit the institutions involved.
Yeah. First of all, without kind of passing on the question of whether fantasy games are protected under the First Amendment, I will say that you got to be careful, because I have seen fantasy games you know, variations on them used to be able to teach young people a lot of things, including mathematics, including organization and things of that nature. Kids learning how to be general managers, if you will, but the skills that are implied as well as expressed in that type of role. So I would say it does have some educational value to some extent, again, without saying whether or not it's protected by the First Amendment. But the second thing that I wanted to get your opinions on, and Marvin, you mentioned that you didn't think a trust fund would work, and I'm curious why not. I mean, university missions are to create leaders. And sports obviously enhances those capabilities, at least in my mind, and it's been my experience of that. But in the end, you know, if you hold something, it's almost like a carrot, something for postgraduate work that will benefit all student-athletes, not just the ones in the revenue-producing sports or anything like that. What would be wrong with establishing a trust fund? And that trust fund could grow exponentially year after year after year based on some of these things for the benefit of student-athletes who aren't going to be professional athletes, who are going to go on and develop their leadership capabilities after school. So I'm curious as to what would be wrong with a trust fund.
I mean, I think that's just another option. I don't think anything's wrong with it. I would just prefer to see those benefits as a student-athlete come to me right now, directly. No. And that's why I said I don't want the stipend check. I don't want the cash in my hand. But I do want to be able to say that because of the revenue that I'm generating, I get that benefit now.
Well, you do get the benefit if you choose to go on. That's the carrot. Choose to go on and get a postgraduate degree. That's the choice you can make.
But also with the medical insurance or some other different areas that money could go to right now that could help me right now. And that's what I would almost like to see as a student athlete before saying, well, if I do get a postgraduate scholarship, that's there. What if I don't want to go to grad school? What if that's not in my, you know, in my future? Well, then what happens?
Well, it may not be in your future. It might be in somebody else's future. This is, again, for the greater good. You talked about utilization. It's also utilitarianism, too. Doing it for the greater good.
And the greater good can see, whether it's medical insurance or what have you, that
those
funds can help.
Medical insurance is not an option. Sometimes that's an individual institutional situation or something along those lines. Some, like Jeremy said, some of the haves might be able to provide that in some way, shape, or form. The have-nots may not have the resources. But something that goes across the board, in my mind, that ultimately provides that carrot to continue to develop leadership capabilities, I think, is certainly something that we need to look at.
Jerry, your question.
Yeah, the issue that had triggered a lot of the conversation this morning was around, you know, the right of the student athlete to use their name, to control their name, control their image, and who has the right to do that. We've been discussing it without really questioning student athletes about what your views are on that. So I guess I have a two or three part question. One is, if all the court rulings came up and you were given the right to control whether your image is and name is in fantasy football or in one of the video games, do you want that right? Secondly, if you had that right, what would you do with it? Would you say yes or no? And thirdly, what do you think the student athletes that you knew when you were back in college what percentage of them would say yes or no?
Well, I'll answer, I guess, that question by first saying this. Overall, you know, we, like I said earlier, I'd want to see my name and I'd want to see that likeness in a video game and be excited about it. But at the same time, I don't want to lose the excitement of the college experience. I wouldn't want to have to worry about having a lawyer to determine or to put together a contract over publicity rights. I wouldn't want to have to worry about those things coming into school. I would just want to be able to show up and do what, you know, I'm destined to do on the court or in the classroom. And I think with being a student athlete and using your name and likenesses, I think it's a good thing from our perspective while we're there. I think it, you know, we're excited for it. We're excited that, you know, we can see ourselves in that environment.
So you would take, you'd say yes.
I would say yes, and then give us the right to say no if you know, I know Carrie talked about the team concept and promoting team,
right.
But having the individual option of backing out if that endorsement or right. If that contract wasn't something.
And
I
do you
agree.
Think that most of the other student athletes you were with would say yes?
Yes.
Yeah, sometimes I think that I'd be better suited to have been a student athlete in the 1950s. One, because I wasn't quick enough or fast enough most games to keep up with some of today's athletes. But at the same time, while I was on campus, I had an appreciation for what I was a part of. And knowing that I was a part of something that, you know, people like Jesse Owens had come through and, you know, great individuals who had gone on to do great things, Gerald Ford, you know, whoever it may be, I had an appreciation for that opportunity that I had. So I personally would not have wanted to have the ability to be included in those fantasy games. Yes, like Marvin said, have the option to say whether or not, but I definitely would not have been wanted to be included in that, only because I don't know, it's that throwback kind of thinking that, you know, it's, you're there to be a college athlete, you're there to worry about what you do on the field, what you do in the classroom, what you do in a social setting, and to me that's good enough. You don't need to worry about all this kind of stuff. But again, like Marvin said, I think with today's student athlete, I think that most of my teammates, at least, I can't speak for all student athletes, but most of my teammates would have wanted to be included because of the coolness factor, you know, being included in something like that.
You know, I think my take on it is, as a 17, 18, 19-year-old kid, I was in no way prepared. Did I know enough? Was I mature enough to even understand the ramifications of that question? What does it mean to represent myself and my image? For that reason, I don't think it should be in the players. I think there should be some sort of group that is set up that ultimately truly does have the student athletes' rights and best interest in mind, that the players, the athletes rather, have a say-so, they can have input with, but ultimately there's some association that truly is looking out for the rights of the players. Because I know I can look at it now and say, yeah, I'm probably educated enough now. I'm that many years older, wiser. I've seen a lot of things. I've been involved in the business world, and I've seen that stuff. At 17, 18, as a freshman coming out of high school, that would have been way over my head.
Elston, you had a question.
Yeah, first of all, I want to commend you.
Jeremy did.
I'm sorry.
Well, briefly, I'll just say that was one of the discussions sure. This morning that I attached heavily to, and I think it's a big problem. And I think it's unfortunate the NCAA hasn't found a solution to get rid of this in some capacity, because I absolutely agree with Professor Wong that it is a First Amendment right of publicity, and I think that it goes against it. These are these individuals' jerseys, and they're being sold. And I think what has to happen is, first and foremost, Tim Tebow has to know he does have a right of publicity. They don't know that. And I'll certainly facilitate that.
First of all, I want to commend all four of you for an excellent presentation. We thoroughly enjoyed it. My question is fairly simple. With the last panel, I asked them, who served as the advocate for student athletes? And I'm going to ask you the same thing. Who do you view as your advocates when you were a student athlete? Jeremy? And we'll go down the line.
Unbiasedly, nobody.
Okay.
You know, when I ran into this conflict with the NCAA after the 2006 games, I had to go to the NCAA compliance department.
at my university, and they were my representation. And they were the only avenue I had to state my case. So I don't believe, I think the Student Athlete Advisory Committee, I don't believe they're the voice. And I don't think they do enough. Okay. And that's not a personal attack on you, and I hope you don't take it that way, but I don't believe that there's anybody. And it's individuals like you that we get to speak in front of and have the privilege, because we can't change it. We're helpless. I'll never change it. We won't change it, but it's the university presidents and people at the Knight Commission and things like that. If we can interest you enough to take up the positions, then you are our representations.
Henry? Well, I also want to appreciate the panelists. I think it was clear and thoughtful, but I'm not going to be a representative, Jeremy, for the following reasons. First, I want to admit right off that universities benefit from the names, images of their high-performing athletes. There's just no doubt about it. We sell season tickets that way. We put on posters. We don't put 85 football players there. We'll put 6 or 8. We just can't be hypocritical about this. We do. We're looking to enhance our revenues all the time. And it was pointed out in the materials that the Knight Commission has put forward, very few universities make money net from on the bottom line from intercollegiate athletics. We know that. And even if our budgets are reasonably good, we're still, as Jack was saying a moment ago, always trying to enhance the revenue aspects of it. But why I want to weigh in on the other side is I think people should really appreciate, when you look at the university constituencies, how many folks out there already think we privilege student athletes in the following ways, and I think we all know this. One, we give scholarships. In my university, the only merit scholarships are athletic scholarships. We have a few for bassoonists and saxophonists or whatever in the music school, but everybody else is on a need-based scholarship except for student athletes. Now, that's not necessarily true everywhere, but it's true at my university. There are people, faculty and students, who say you're putting a fortune into academic advising for student athletes that you don't do for other students. We all realize that student athletes are away a lot, that they labor very hard with respect to game day, practice, all that's true. But I'm telling you that there are lots of people out there who feel it's overweighted in terms of facilities, advising, tutoring. Finally, we have a very strong feeling, among the faculty and some students, I wouldn't be able to judge the students as well as I would be able to judge faculty, that something's out of balance with regard to the academic side of things and the athletic side. Again, I wouldn't speak at all universities. I can only speak for my own and some that I know. So everything, the schemes that Craig talked about, that Professor Wong talked about, which are clever in a way because they try to avoid the pay-for-play to look for good things, whether it's academic enhancement, insurance. I'm not so sure how I think about that. I might not be negative about that one, medical insurance. But for post-playing, so it's not directly tied to day of game or year of game or 4 years of eligibility. But they still benefit student athletes as compared to other parts of the student population. And thus there's vast resistance out there to those things. And I just think people should appreciate how strong, and I'm not talking about faculty who are ipso facto against intercollegiate athletics. There are faculty like, I'm talking about reasoned faculty. I'm talking about some population of the students and some population of alumni. So I just hope people appreciate that there is a very strong reaction to doing more, and particularly for high-performance student athletes. All the questions of equity that you've all worried about yourself as to who's to benefit from these post-graduation schemes go beyond how you share among athletes to those who are in non-revenue sports and to those who are in revenue sports, those who are high-performing versus those who may not be so high-performing, they go to the heart of athletes and non-athletes who are students. And I think it's just it's a structural problem you can't get around. And I said earlier, I don't know whether the panelists were here, that for lots of universities, they're thinking about what the tipping point may be. And I hope people appreciate that, because there is a tipping point. We don't all know what it's at. I don't know myself. I don't even know what I think about this. But I think people should appreciate that, and something, Britt, you said, that I think you said that we're going in two directions here with pressures everywhere on the academic side of expenses ratcheting up for research, for financial aid, revenues slowing up, and yet there's this other side of things, the athletic side, where very strong impetus to do more. And it's created a tension in the universities, which maybe the best we can do is keep straddling it. And I'm afraid if you do yet another set of things, some of the ones that you all talked about, you push the tipping point yet another place.
Thank you. Good statement.
Of the three panelists to answer Elton's question, he only got one of them. He, on who speaks for the students, athletes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Good.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Remembering back to Jeremy's comments, he kind of came from an unbiased perspective. I'm going to come from a biased perspective and say that the Student Athlete Advisory Committee actually does do a very good job of representing the issues that affect Division I student athletes. And one of the things that we are always have an issue with and struggle with is we can only bring forth what is brought forth to us. And I know that reading a couple news clippings from back when you were in your issue while you were at Colorado, you did contact the Student Athlete Advisory Committee, and I certainly appreciate that. But we have a lot of inroads into the NCAA membership, be it through committees. As I mentioned, we have a breakfast with the board of directors every January at the convention. And we have representatives that get to serve at external constituencies such as this, the Knight Commission meeting. So we do have a great chance and a great built-in line of communication to get information out there if it is brought to us. And we have no problem fighting on behalf of the Division I student athletes with issues such as fantasy sports, which, as I mentioned, we will be talking about in November. So I really think it is a great system that's in place that has a lot of inroads that can really promote change.
Not to question the system, I guess my biggest issue with the system would be there's a lack of information out there. I know as a former student athlete, I would have to agree with Jeremy in a sense that I didn't think there was anyone out there. Now, fortunately, I was in a position where I never had to lean on somebody. I mean, my career, from all intents and purposes, went smoothly. Academically, I did very well. Athletically, I had some opportunities that I capitalized on, and I'm sure the university benefited. I benefited, and kind of going back to your comments, I don't have a problem with the university benefiting from my name. I don't have a problem with them selling more tickets, putting more people in parking spaces, selling more concessions. It's the third party entities that I think, until something's done about it. Kerry said he dislikes strongly the word exploitation, but to me, until something's done about it, it is exploitation. And until a path can be taken, that's when it becomes utility. That's when it's actually used. But kind of answering two questions there, kind of wanted to get a comment in. But I guess long-winded answer was, I didn't really feel there was anybody there that would go to bat for a major issue.
Marvin, wrap it up.
I feel very similar to the rest of the guys in that I didn't feel like there was anybody either. Initially, of course, my family, and as a student athlete, my first line of defense to me was my coach. I went to him because I didn't get all the education in regards to what SAC did and what SAC could really do, because that information wasn't coming to us. So really, it was coach and the institution. But deep down, I knew I was, at the end of the day, I was on my own.
And really quickly, I'll be really quick, just to touch on that. My issue, just to illustrate how closed the door is, at the very, very beginning, I requested to speak to Mr. Brand, the NCAA president, and present my case and see if there's ways to work out, and it was denied.
So there's no, you cannot talk to these people. They will not talk to you. They will not have a meeting with you.
All right, we need to wrap it up here at 12. I do thank our panelists and would say that we do have a lunch break here from 12 to 12:45. The Knight Commission and the panelists would meet in the First Amendment Lounge here, or right behind us, for lunch. The media and all others will reconvene back at 1 o'clock, but we would invite our panelists from both groups to join us for lunch here in the First Amendment Lounge. And again, all others will meet you back here at 1 o'clock. Thank the four of you. Let's give them a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. For more information, visit www.knightcommission.org.